Welcome to Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Tara Gatewood. If the electricity went out for a week or a winter storm had you stranded in your home, would you be prepared to survive? Would you be safe? Even in the most bustling city, disaster can strike and leave people without the basic necessities. Should a disaster strike, do you have a plan? What about the right supplies for the whole family? There are things you can do to be prepared, and there are also things you could be doing wrong. Join us for our discussion on being prepared for the worst, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Obama addressed the Tribal Nations Conference Thursday in Washington, D.C., but in a departure from his past addresses to tribal leaders, this time he took questions from a panel of young people. Matt Laszlo reports.
At past Tribal Nation conferences, President Obama delivered speeches to tribal leaders. Not this time. He sat down for a panel discussion with young Alaska Natives and Native Americans. The first black president of the U.S. told the youth that being a minority should be viewed as a means of empowerment and not something anyone should hide from.
It's not a betrayal of your traditions to understand those tools and use them on behalf of your community and on behalf of yourself.
Obama was asked about how tribes can tackle childhood obesity, while others asked about getting running water. The president agreed more resources are needed, but he said Congress needs to grapple with a question.
How do we give tribes the tools whereby they can start generating jobs and economic development and progress on their own terms within their communities?
The president deferred to the panel of students on many questions, like on how to combat the high rate of suicides in Indian country, but no definitive initiative was proposed in the meeting. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The U.S. Department of Justice is suing the South Dakota Department of Social Services for alleged discriminatory hiring practices. The complaint was filed this week in federal court. Victoria Wicks reports.
The case started in 2010 when DSS listed a vacancy at Pine Ridge for an employment specialist. That employee assists people receiving benefits to get jobs. According to the complaint, Cedric Goodman and four other Native people applied for the job along with one white applicant. Goodman had the education and experience called for, including a bachelor's degree, 30 hours toward a master's degree, 5 years of social work, and 4 years as an employment specialist. After conducting interviews, DSS closed the vacancy but reopened it the following day and ended up hiring a white female recent college graduate with no applicable experience. The complaint charges DSS with a pattern of discrimination, hiring non-Indians for higher-paying specialist jobs and Native people for lesser-paying jobs. DOJ says DSS uses arbitrary and subjective decision-making to reject Native applicants in favor of non-Native applicants. A 2-year review of DSS practices indicates 92% of hires for specialist positions were white and 8% or one person was Native. DOJ charges that DSS closes positions rather than hiring qualified Native applicants. The relief sought includes that DSS stop discriminating and adopt a selection process that complies with federal employment law. Other sanctions include putting Goodman in the next employment specialist job that comes open at Pine Ridge and awarding back pay and other damages to applicants. DSS has not yet filed a response. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Petroglyphs are the focus of a festival this weekend in Southern California, which includes tours, a film showcase, and a powwow. Christina Onnestead has more.
The ancient Native American rock writings date back 10,000 years, and the Ridgecrest Petroglyph Festival is celebrating them. Doug Luke, the executive director of the Ridgecrest Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, which is the lead organizer of the event, says for the first time they'll offer tours of the petroglyphs.
They're actually all over the valley, but the main cluster is on the Navy Weapons Center, and there's the biggest concentration of petroglyphs in the Western Hemisphere. It's on our base.
Luke says the tours are aimed at educating the public about indigenous people, including the 9 Native American tribes in the region. Luke says last year an estimated 15,000 people attended. He expects a similar large turnout this year. Christina Onnestead, National Native News, California.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support provided by Shoshone Bannock Tribal Farms, proud producer of free-range, sustainable buffalo jerky. Holiday delivery of original, peppered, and teriyaki buffalo jerky available on orders placed by December 15th. More information at sbtribalfarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. If the storm of the decade cut electricity to your house for a week, would you be prepared? What if a flood or wildfire threatened your home? What kind of plan do you have in place? And some people worry about other disasters like the collapse of the U.S. economy, and there's even guidelines if some unforeseen virus turns part of the population into zombies floating around the internet. And planning for such events now has its own nickname, prepping. So we ask, would you call yourself a prepper? If so, just what are you preparing for and why? We're talking about prepping for disaster today, and you can join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. And we have a few preparedness experts with us to share their wisdom and answer your questions that you might have. And you can call in. Our phone lines are open right now. And do you have an emergency plan? Have you ever turned a disaster plan just to turn to one of them to get your family out of a jam? Give us a call and tell us how you prepared to survive, or perhaps how you failed in preparing and the lessons you learned then. The number to join us today is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And of course, 1-800-996-2848 is the number too. And it's our pleasure to be welcoming here in Studio 49, Lauren D'Acevedo. And he is the owner of the Tactical Survival Systems here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's our pleasure to welcome Lauren to the hour. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. And Lauren, a lot of people hear this word, preppers. And recently you were at the Preppers Expo USA here in Albuquerque. And we want to hear, you know, anything interesting that you learned from this event.
I think there's a big misconception between what people prep for, and a lot of it has to do with television today. When you look at some of the shows that are out there that show the absolute extremes and the fringes, such as Doomsday Prepper, Doomsday Prepper actually started very benignly. And to, I'm assuming, keeping the ratings going, they had to find the fringes to make it more interesting and keep a viewer base. And the other one is The Walking Dead, which has now spun off The Fear of the Walking Dead. And that's another extreme. What I tell the people, and what we've discussed at the expo when we gave the lecture there, was that you need to really prep locally, prep for what you fear the most could be an emergency that will affect your family. Not these, and I'll call them Hollywood type of disasters that may occur. Yes, they could occur. Then I also ask, okay, so out of those Hollywood disasters, pick one that you actually think could happen. It could be the super volcano. It could be an EMP attack. It depends on what you want to do. And that's your long-range goal for prepping. But short-range should be very simple, should be at home, and you should be ready to go.
All right. Thanks for that, Lauren. You know what? We're going to give folks a taste of just exactly what you're talking about. The name of the program is Doomsday Preppers on the National Geographic Channel. And here is a scene from one of their episodes.
The prospect of a future without readily available food drives Paul and Gloria to cook not three, but eight meals a day, allowing them to put aside enough food each week to survive an extra 11 post-apocalyptic days.
What kind of chicken are you making?
The chimichanga base.
Oh, chimichanga base. And we're gonna can that?
Yep.
The 25 pounds of chicken they preserve today has enough protein to sustain four people for 6 days.
We're preparing for family and friends
We're not just preparing for the two of us.
And the family featured on that episode was preparing for the earth to tilt and wipe out all kinds of necessities. And if you've seen this show, how accurate of a portrayal do you think it is when it comes to people being prepared? And our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And so, Lauren, there we go. Just an example of extremes and, you know, cooking that much food. I think the heart of the matter, too, what I'm hearing from you, too, is not necessarily, you know, freaking out, but thinking about your environment, where you are, and really, you know, just that first question of what would I do, I believe is a primary step or something important. What do you think, Lauren?
Well, the first step is actually have a family plan together. If there is an emergency, it could be anything. Now we're getting ready for the El Nino season. We've already had our first taste of snow yesterday here locally. Do people prepare for an earthquake first here, or do we prepare for something that we are being told could happen? And that's what you need to do. And part of that, number one thing you need to do is have a family plan. Basically, get together with your spouse, anyone else that lives in the household, children, what have you, and discuss it. If there's an emergency, what do we do? Who do we contact? How do we contact you? I mean, the cell phones may go down, towers may go down due to a blizzard. And I think right now, locally here in Albuquerque and New Mexico and the Southwest, we need to start to consider that. What do we do if a blizzard does hit and we're cut off for 3 days from being able to go to the grocery store? But what happens that day that they tell us the blizzard's coming, kids get let home from school early? Where's our rally point? Where are we going to go? Are we going to go home, or are we going to go to grandma's house? That needs to be discussed, because that will be chaos that day.
And Lauren, what are your thoughts? Why do we refrain from having, you know, I mean, what you're saying is seems pretty logical. Why do we refrain from doing that? What do you think that's about?
There's a psychological thing that nobody wants to talk about bad things. Nobody wants to talk about disaster. Nobody wants to talk about emergency, but we need to do it. That's probably the first thing. Second of which, they really don't understand how to put that into a framework. Actually, FEMA's done a very good job of providing forms for family communication plans. You can go online and download them, and just start there. There is your outline, and begin with that. Very simple to do. FEMA's also provided great lists for family planning, for actually having what you should have on hand, family kits. So it's very simple if you want to take the first step. It's there for you. No one's telling you that you have to cook 8 meals a day and 23 pounds of chicken. That's way out there.
And, you know, he just handed me the plan that he was talking about. And I think it's real interesting how there are so many spaces for phone numbers. And you might think, wow, these are the ones you have all the time. But if we're going to be realistic, so many people use cell phones and they don't know anybody's number.
Great point. How many people today actually have a real landline in their home anymore? Very few. I mean, even though we have what we consider, it's actually a cell-based phone. And that's very vulnerable. And it's vulnerable for a lot of things. I mean, blizzards can bring down cell towers, so you may have sporadic outages. And overload. I mean, I saw it during Hurricane Andrew when I was in South Florida. The cell phone, this is early times for cell phone technology, it went down. New York, same thing happened during September 11th. The cell systems just crashed because there were so many people on it. That can happen on a regional or a localized basis also. So you have to have secondary backups. Okay, if you can't get a hold of anybody, this is your rally point. And I use a military term, and it works today. This is where we're going to get together, or either we're going to get together here and then go home, or this is where we're going to stay. That is important for everyone in the family to know.
And does your family practice any of this? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And are you here today because you were prepared in a past emergency or disaster? What's your story? Share it with us. Again, our number is 1-800-996-2848. And are any conversations like this happening in your own community? Again, give us a call or send us a tweet at 1-800-996-2848. 99 Native. Lauren, a couple of weeks ago, our senior producer, Monica Brain, went to a Preppers Expo USA, which was taking place here in Albuquerque. And she met with several people about, you know, why they were there and why they felt being prepared was something that they should really focus on. She met with Jackie Flood of MedPax USA. And here's what Jackie had to say about being medically prepared.
Medical stuff we use every day. We always are falling and tripping or somebody cuts themselves, stuff like that. I believe there will come a time when we will not be able to make it to the emergency room. We will not be able to get an ambulance to come. And we need to learn to take care of ourselves. I also pack myself medical kits designed for different purposes, from a field hospital bag that weighs 20 pounds, it's got everything in it that you would need to take care of yourself and your family, down to a bag for your horse and puppy. You know, you can never have enough medical supplies on hand, and if something really catastrophic does happen, you'll have more than your family there to take care of.
And Lauren, I want to get your take on when it just comes to, you know, medical supplies or having a plan there, you know, for physical safety. What do you think about when a prepper should start looking for medical supplies to add to? And I hear a lot of people keep survival kits. Your thoughts, Lauren?
Survival kits and medical kits are two completely different realms, and we can get into those specifically. I'd like to my background is in medicine for many years, and I see this almost on a daily basis where people are buying equipment and they have medical equipment, but they don't know how to use it. That goes. I preach learning skills, and it can start as early as putting your kids in Scouts, taking the American Red Cross first aid course. I think everyone should take that. In a household, it's just basic sense to do that. Then there's equipment out there that is above the realm of the average person. And actually, I'll go back to your Doomsday Preppers show. I was in awe one time when I saw them actually show on TV someone inserting an IV incorrectly. So, you know, you got to be careful that you don't get trained the wrong way. So a lot of this equipment is way beyond the realm of the average person. However, the argument also is on the other side where, well, it's better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it. And maybe you can find somebody, a neighbor who's a nurse, a neighbor who's a physician, who knows how to use the equipment. I agree with that. The basic thing that everybody should take into consideration, part of their medical kit, is if they are on some sort of medication, prescribed medication, they must make sure that they have adequate amounts to go through an emergency. And a lot of people don't do that. I know now it's all automated with prescriptions getting mailed to you all the time, but you need to speak to your physician and explain to them, hey, I may be unable to get my prescriptions filled. Can you give me a prescription for an emergency supply? And it's very common. There's actually a form that's online that's available from Dr. Alton that explains it to the physician why it's important to have backup medication. That's number one. Here in the Southwest, especially amongst the Native American tribes, here in New Mexico, we have double the national average of diabetes. That means most people are on insulin. Insulin's not a product that you can store long term. So that's important for anybody here, that if they are diabetic and they are on insulin, that they have an adequate supply to get through an emergency. And it's very important.
Sure, that's a great point to bring up, Lauren. And you know, when we do talk about being prepared or thinking about things we should know, your suggestion of just knowing basic first aid things, can you give me any examples of things that would help us, say a disaster strikes, just common knowledge about the body or, how to help somebody who might be in need? You know, what are some of those skills that you think that we could all, most of us could, pick up those skills and be ready?
CPR is almost a common day training now everywhere. I think everyone should be trained in CPR. And again, I'll go back to the basic first aid skills. It would be nice if people would go beyond that and go to the basic EMT classes and take those basic EMT classes, because then you get into a different level of treatment, emergency treatment. There's going back to your question, what it's up to you. You may not like medicine. A lot of people are squeamish about blood. So you may not be the person in your family to be the medical person. So you need to identify who's actually got an aptitude for it. Again, Boy Scouts have great training for basic survival skills and also for first aid. So that's a good place for kids to start getting trained also.
Thanks for that. And folks, we do want to hear from you today, too. You know, how seriously do you take preparing for disaster? Give us a call. The phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And if disaster struck, would you and your family know what to do? What if you had to evacuate your home? Do you know what you should take with you? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. And I want to go, you know, a lot of us think of, you know, if something were to happen, we think of our own abilities as people. And I think, you know, quickly we start thinking, oh boy, you know, how in shape am I? You know, would I be able to handle something that goes down? Bob Modest was also at the Albuquerque Prepper Expo USA. He's a veteran and a personal trainer who developed a military-based method of physical fitness.
If anybody's seen Zombieland, they have rule number one where somebody's running across a football field in big letters it says rule number one, cardio. Rule number one is perfect for what I do because I'm at a prepper show and I'm a personal trainer and it fits exactly with the show. When you talk to preppers, preppers are the biggest collectors of guns and military equipment and all sorts of cool looking stuff. But if you ask them, do you drive to the Walmart two blocks away or do you walk to the Walmart two blocks away? Everybody says they drive.
And Lauren, Bob makes a point when he talks about cardio being important. What would you say about cardio? You know, would it be at the top of your list when it comes to being prepared physically?
Irregardless of being a prep or not, everybody should be, and I'm one to talk, everybody should be in shape. So I agree with Bob on that, and I know Bob very well. Yes, it should be. Here's a good example. Let's say you're driving along I-40 and the snow hits and you're 20 miles from home and you're not moving your car, but you were prepared and you have your little basic kit in the car and your snowshoes. So you're going to hump it for 20 miles in snowshoes. Yeah, you should be in good shape. But again, emergencies, you can't really go hindsight on that and say, wow, I should have been prepared for you. You need to do it up front. And that's with everything, not just physical conditioning.
All right. Thanks for that, Lauren. And he's going to be here with us the full hour. If you have any questions for him, you can call in. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And I know a lot of times, you know, it is about the individual being prepared. But, you know, a lot of times it also depends on your community and how prepared your community is. And when you think of your own tribal nation, are there plans in place so that if something were to happen, that your community would know what to do or even have a plan for keeping its citizens safe? Call us right now. Share your thoughts. 1-800-996-2848. We're going to turn to a gentleman who knows quite a bit about this. He is joining us today from Tulsa, Oklahoma. We have Patrick Vacha on the line, and he's the Deputy Chief for the Division of Emergency Management for the Bureau of Indian Affairs based in Nashville. And Patrick, we do appreciate you being with us today, and welcome to the hour.
Thanks for having me.
And Patrick, anything you want to start us off with, you know, when we turn this conversation to look at it as on the community level about being prepared for disaster, what do you think is critical to be considering?
Well, I think kind of the importance of individual preparedness is underutilized and I think understressed. When a tribal government or any government or community plans for an emergency, you know, they're planning with infrastructure in mind and those types of things. But they also need to look at, you know, you're going to have 10 to 20% of your population typically is going to have some kind of special need, whether it's elders, people on dialysis with medical issues, people with functional and access needs. So those folks, you always know they're going to need a little bit of extra help. If the other 80% are well prepared, it makes the government's job easier to be able to get through the incident and then go ahead and recover. So, you know, folks that are able to, and I know Lauren mentioned the FEMA, they've got Ready.gov, and a couple years ago they launched Ready.gov Indian Country that looks to some of the unique things about the tribal communities. Red Cross also has great information for the individual. But the less of a burden you are to others, the easier it's going to be for your government, your community as a whole, to be able to get through and then eventually recover from the incident.
And Patrick, you know, I understand that you know about this firsthand by how different tribes have reacted, even this year. Anything you want to share about emergency management and where, you know, the agency stepped in to help people across Native America this year?
Yeah, well, tribes run the gamut with respect to how sophisticated their emergency management programs are. Some have very sophisticated programs. Some really have no program at all. Tribes have been at a disadvantage. All the post-Katrina and post-9/11 money that was sent out to do that type of planning really went to the states, and it didn't get down to the tribes like I guess folks thought it would be. So they're a little bit behind the curve. So we work with not only our group and FEMA, USDA, so some of our other partners, but the Tribal Assistance Coordination Group, which is why I'm in Tulsa. We just had our workshop here this week. Where we try to be kind of a, for lack of a better term, a one-stop shop for a tribal government, that if they're having an incident, they're overwhelmed, they're lacking key resources, how can we bring resources to bear as quickly as we can, as not only the federal family, but volunteer organizations, whether it's Red Cross, Southern Baptist, those types of things, to be able to assist them. So it's very overwhelming. Most tribal emergency managers are typically not full-time. A lot of times they're wearing three or four different hats. You know, priorities vary, and you can completely understand that. So being able to try to make it easier for them to get access to the resources they need for their response to the incident, be it the flood or whatever it might be, is our continuing goal, and that's that. There's still a long way to go.
All right. Thanks for that, Patrick. We're going to continue to hear about, you know, different perspectives when it comes to being prepared. But, you know, as we get ready to go into our second half of the hour, you know, if there's anything you would like to add, maybe you learned your lesson the last time something struck and you have some really good advice that you'd like to share with others, you can give us a call. Our phone lines are open. We want to know what you do to be prepared for disaster. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And is one of the biggest hurdles in being prepared, just even talking about it? You know, do cultural issues come into play where preparing for disaster is almost welcoming it? If you'd like to make comments on that, you can give us a call. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And we do want to hear from you. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And, you know, what are the essentials to know when disaster strikes? Call us right now. We do want to hear from you, whether it be just understanding the situation or even having a plan. Give us a call, Native America. We do want to hear from you. And you can also call in and ask your questions, too. We want to hear from you. I'm Tara Gatewood, host of Native America Calling. This month, we connect with First Nations journalist and musician Wob Kanu and his new memoir, The Reason You Walk. We invite you to join us as we visit with this Native author and get his take on politics, as well as Native culture and its role in sustaining strong tribal nations.
Matches struck from the clouds. I heard the sky cry out loud. And all her tears shook the ground. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Feel the heat nipping at my feet. A fairy fire is chasing after me. A fairy fire.
Support by the 2015 Indian Ag Youth Alliance Essay Contest and Conference. The 2015 Indian Ag Youth Alliance Essay Contest is open to Native American youth enrolled in a federally recognized tribe or descendants living on Indian-owned land and entering grades 9 through 12 this school year. Students may submit an essay to apply by November 9th. Information and the It's All About That Ag video at IndianAgLink.com/youth. Youth are vital to Indian agriculture.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and I also wanted to give you a heads up. We are going to check in again with Randy Taylor. He's at the Indian National Finals Rodeo this week, and we're going to get another update of some of the action. But today we are discussing preparedness, and one disaster people often joke about is a zombie apocalypse. But the state of Kansas has gone as far as to designate October as Zombie Preparedness Month, and the campaign is the state's way to draw attention to gearing up for more likely scenarios like an aftermath of a tornado. And Kansas has also put out a preparedness challenge to help citizens prepare for emergencies. So when you hear this, would you say that they are ahead of the game? Do you wish your own state was doing something like this? Maybe even your own tribal nation. Has your tribal nation issued a preparedness challenge? And are you prepared to survive for a few days if you got snowed in? Or if a tornado whipped through your community, would you have enough supplies for your whole family and pets, too? Give us a call. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. It's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And you can share your thoughts, too. You know, do you think preparing is a good use of your time and money? Or maybe you're always ready for the worst because you were caught off guard once before. Again, you can call in and tell us how you prepared. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And with us today from Tulsa, Oklahoma is Patrick Vacha, and he's the Deputy Chief for the Division of Emergency Management for the Bureau of Indian Affairs based in Nashville. Also here in Studio 49, we have Lauren De Acevedo, and he is the owner of Tactical Survival Systems here in Albuquerque. It's our pleasure to welcome both gentlemen back. And gentlemen, we have a caller on the line we're going to bring in. Sue is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's listening to KUNM Radio. Sue, what would you like to add to the hour?
Yes, hi. I went through Hurricane Andrew with my family back in 1992 in South Florida. And we had, you know, a bunch of frozen food in the freezer. And then, but when that power goes out, you know, we've wasted a lot of money. And so it was stressful because we were trying to cook it all ahead and put it in, you know, in ice chests. And then the landlord didn't want us to put up hurricane shutters. He was really cold about it. He said, well, if you put up, you know, anything, you'll have to pay for damages. So then my other point is, after the storm, people have to know the traffic rules about the four-way stop. And even in New Mexico, maybe there could be PSAs telling people if there's a power outage, you know, you have to observe the four-way stop rule because there are a lot of car accidents, there's a lot of glass around. So my, I guess I have a couple of questions is, you know, how do we balance how much really frozen food to have on hand in case of a power outage? And how do we prepare with our landlord to find out, you know, what are they going to allow? And then the PSAs would be a good idea. Thank you so much.
All right, Sue, thank you for your call. And Patrick, go ahead and start us off. Anything for Sue?
Well, I just the public service announcements, that job has fortunately gotten quite a bit easier with the advent of social media. So being able to get that message out is a lot easier than it used to be. That was one of the things we were discussing this week, that, you know, press releases anymore are they're dated before the time they're even, you know, finished being typed. That social media, whether Facebook, Twitter, whatever else, really helps to make that happen. And being able to manage that during an event is really important. And we get more questions about that as we provide technical assistance for tribes that are doing some emergency management planning.
All right. And Patrick, anything on the food?
No, you know, I mean, obviously the best case scenario would be a whole home generator, but they're expensive. You know, some smaller generators aren't as expensive, but they're still, you know, several thousand dollars. But, if it's a hurricane, obviously, if you can see it coming, you can plan a little bit more. But if it's a tornado or something like that, then there's not much you can do other than try to get it into coolers.
All right. Thanks, Patrick. Lauren, anything to add?
Being a fellow Hurricane Andrew, I don't want to say victim because we actually did very well.
Survivor.
Okay. Frozen foods are not part of any preparedness plan. It's just we went through the same thing. Fortunately, we had a generator. We were the only one on the block, which is another issue altogether. When you're the only one with power, everybody kind of looks at you differently during an event. So that's something you have to be aware of. But what you typically, and going through this in South Florida, the barbecues go on and everybody starts to cook what's in the freezer, in the refrigerator. But frozen food is definitely not part of that inventory. Canned food, non-perishables, that's part of a preparedness inventory. As far as the PSAs go, it's interesting that you mentioned the four-way stop because I was actually in Miami and going through an intersection, somebody just crashed right into my brand-new pickup. And because all the lights were out. So I get it. And you're right. But I think we all have to use common sense in that. If the light's out or the light's literally laying in the middle of the road, you would think that you'd want to stop and see what else is going to be an obstacle or what other dangers are out there. So I think that's a lot to do with common sense.
You know, something that I think of, you know, when you start asking yourself some of those questions, you know, what would you do in an emergency like this? My first thought is water, making sure that I have access to water. And I think that can get really complicated really quick, you know, especially if the power is out. Lauren, anything you want to share about just, you know, considering your water supply if things go, you know, if things get bad?
Well, actually, the water is the number one item that people talk about. Here in the Southwest, we have issues. Obviously, here we don't have a lot of surface water. Groundwater is deep, so a lot of people have wells, and the people that do have wells rely on electric pumps. And then we kind of dive into the economics of it. Yes, you can have a backup solar system for your pump. It gets expensive. So people tend to store water. Luckily, a side effect that I see now is people gathering water from their gutters and what have you. That's great, but that water is not potable. So it has to be filtered, has to be cleansed. That brings to the second problem. Storing water at home is somewhat simple. In Florida, they used to say, okay, everybody fill up your bathtubs. Well, take a good look at your bathtub. I don't think I'd want to drink the water out of a typical bathtub. So now on the market is a liner, which is very inexpensive, and I like to promote those because they are very practical, where you fill up a plastic liner with water, and it is ready to go. It's potable water. Most people have one or two tubs in their houses, so they can store between 80 and 100 in an emergency situation. But going to what Patrick said, that's if you know that something's going to happen. You can pre-store that water. Most people should store at least 3 days worth of water in their home for an emergency. That's minimum 3 days. And it typically, the rule of thumb is 1 gallon per person per day. And you can buy inexpensive, under a dollar, water at any of the grocery stores or Walmart and what have you, and store those at home. That's probably the best place to start. And you can get more technical as you develop your skills as a prepper, if you want to use that term.
All right. Thanks for that, Lauren. And folks, if you have advice, you can call us too. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And now joining us from the Seattle area is Linda Zambrano, and she's the executive director of the National Tribal Emergency Management Council and the Northwest Tribal Emergency Management Council. It's our pleasure to welcome Linda to the hour. Hello, Linda.
Good morning, and thank you for having us as a guest.
Linda, thank you for being with us. We're in the middle of a great discussion. And all summer long, we've been hearing about wildfires in the Northwest area. In that type of situation, you know, what does it mean to be prepared for the worst? What can you add, Linda?
Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, you're right. We've dealt with a number of different disasters over the past 2 years. We had a very large windstorm that came through our Colville Nation, one of our largest tribal nations in the state of Washington, that literally took out 60 miles of power lines. We also had our big Oso mudslide, which unfortunately took 43 of our citizens' lives and traumatically affected our Foxwaddle tribe and our Stillaguamish tribe. We've also had the wildland fires over the course of several months in eastern Washington. And the most important thing that we have found is that our tribal nations have emergency management personnel that are in place that can help be in the driver's seat of managing those incidents when they happen within the tribe. One of the other things that our organization has done is really promote the CERT program, the Community Emergency Response Team training. We've been successful in being able to provide that training to more than 1,500 of our tribal members throughout the state of Washington. And that training helps people learn more about disaster preparedness and things that they can do to be more prepared and things that they should be storing and how to store them and all of the things that that our guests have been talking about today. If I were going to address anything, I'd like to get back to what we were talking about earlier, and that's the psychological issues that keep people from preparing. People are very busy today, and I think that when we talk about preparedness as something that we have to do, people view it as one more thing they have to do, one more thing they have to add to the list. And what we really try to promote is that we get away from telling people that it's something we need to do, and perhaps more going towards incorporating it as a way of life. The best example that I like to use is that my son, who's a Tulalip tribal member, has had a disaster emergency kit since he was born. When he was first brought into this world, we created a kit for him that had all of the necessities that he needed. He had some special medical needs, and we wanted to make sure that we always had those things available if something should ever happen. In working for the Tulalip Police Department, I was deployed one time on a tsunami alert, and my young child at the age of 8, he said, "It's okay, Mom, if you go to work, because I've got my emergency kit." And so if we can move in the direction as parents, as community leaders, as people that are in positions of being able to provide training and teach our communities how to be more prepared, and help our communities understand that it needs to be more of a way of life than something that we do, I think we can be far more successful in better preparing our communities.
And Linda, you know, what more do you think it has to take? Does it has to be, you know, more of our community getting involved? You know, do we also need to be hearing this message coming from our tribal leaders? And I want to bring attention to a tweet that we got. A gentleman shared on our Twitter account that he teaches a CERT class and hardly anyone shows up. He says, as of now, only a few tribal members are actually showing up. It looks like he might be based, you know, in the Tulalip area. Linda, you know, how do we turn this around?
It at this point in time, we have very few tribal emergency managers nationally. I think that Patrick spoke a little bit to the funding that became available early on. And as the years have passed, that funding has dwindled, and there's been less and less funding available to support tribal emergency management. I think that this is an issue that needs to go clear back to D.C., that we need to be advocating for more funding for our tribal nations, that our tribal nations are able to employ those emergency managers, that they're able to fully exercise tribal sovereignty and be in the driver's seat of any disaster or incident or event that happens on their reservation, that we have people that are in place that are able to get this message out to the tribal communities, helping them to understand how important that this issue is, and people that can help advocate for that training. That's what we need to be able to do.
All right. Thanks for that, Linda. Patrick, anything to add?
Well, the advocacy role is something that we struggle with in the federal government, quite frankly. I mean, the kind of the progression of emergency management for a community or a government is, you know, all emergencies start local. So in theory, you're a small town or a city, your resources are overwhelmed, so then you would go to the county, and then if the county becomes overwhelmed, they go to the state, and then the state becomes overwhelmed, then they'll go to the feds, FEMA, or whoever they need to. For a tribe, they can cut all that out. Their sovereign status and our trust responsibility says if the tribe chooses not to work with the county or work with the state, they can go right to the feds, and that's still something that you know, even I think it's gotten better over the last five or six years, that folks still don't understand. They can't understand that progression is not the same for a tribe that it is for just a regular small community. So advocacy is something that cuts across all spectrums of emergency management for tribal governments.
All right. Thanks, Patrick. And Linda, you know, we've opened, the discussion to just knowing the basics. Anything in your ears, in your years of working in emergency management, any great lessons learned that you feel we should also add to this conversation?
Great lessons learned, I think, would be to take a look at some of the incidents that have occurred, take a look at some of the after action plans that have been created that have looked at what did we do well and what did we not do well, and start implementing plans to improve on the things that did not go well. What I've observed personally is that we have had a number of events. There have been a lot of lessons learned. We've identified a lot of the problems that occurred during some of those events. But what we haven't been real good at is developing the plans to make sure that those mistakes that were made are not repeated in the future. And I think that our emergency management community could spend a little bit more time in looking how it is that we can make sure we don't repeat the same mistakes again. I think Patrick also did a really good job of outlining that our emergency management incidents are often managed at the local level. And anything that we can do to continue to improve on local relations between our tribes, our county partners, our state partners, is definitely something that is critical to this entire process and something that can be added to the conversation.
All right, thanks for that. Let's take a call. We have Laura in Acoma Pueblo in New Mexico listening to KUNM. Laura, you're on air.
Hi all. I was warned that I don't have a lot of time, but I just wanted to make a comment in regards to people not taking preparedness seriously. And I'm wondering, you know, what everyone's thoughts are as far as, you know, calling it the zombie apocalypse, if it's the whole zombie concept is marginalizing the idea of preparedness. Because what I had always learned was that the zombies were the people who aren't prepared, and they're the people that are feeding off of the prepared people.
All right. Great point, Laura. I'm going to toss that one to Lauren. What do you think? Do you think some of what we see in the media has downplayed how important all of this is?
To a certain point, yes. But I think it's also done good in bringing it to the awareness to people that never really thought about it. The old saying is that there's no such thing as bad publicity, and I think this actually works to a certain point. Now, there are, like we were talking earlier about your show, that it does bring out fringe elements, and that's not necessarily it. There's, by estimates, they say there's 3 million preppers in the United States. I think it's more than that. I think a lot of people don't identify themselves as preppers. South Florida alone, I think the whole state's preppers because they're ready for a hurricane almost always, and they're constantly being told to do that. Linda was speaking about as far as when it relates to tribal governments, the Navajo Nation actually was one of the first nations to institute a central supply point and a distribution center for food and medical supplies for emergencies. They were one of the first. But then again, they're the largest one in the country, 27,000 square miles and over 300 members. So they have it's almost a state. And actually, it would be the 11th largest state by landmass if it was part of the United States in that point. So, yes, they need to take the lead again and show other tribal governments that it can be done. Because they did it on a very large scale and they did a good job.
All right, thanks for that. And you know, there are a lot of takes when it comes to being prepared. You've heard, you know, just kind of brushing on some of the basics on today's program. There's lots of information out there. I think some of the the requests for people to put together in an emergency kit. And Linda, it's amazing to hear that such a young person, you know, is got their mind thinking on this. You know, at least our young ones are getting involved in this. I think that's a great thing. You know, sometimes there's suggestions of just even having, you know, a flashlight, a first aid kit, even extra clothing and blankets, especially as we go into our winter, you know, season. There's a lot of great information out there, too. And, you know, this just brushes on the top of it. It has definitely been our pleasure to hear what tribes, you know, might be doing out there. And we're going to continue to, you know, pick up on this kind of conversation throughout the year. If you have any suggestions on how to really get us to, you know, some of the folks who are really concerned about making sure their communities are prepared, you are welcome to reach out to us. Who is working on this in your community? And again, what is working when it comes to getting the message out to your tribal communities? You can always send us an email. Our address is comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And we are also on social media too. You can always send us a tweet. Links are welcome as well. And you can find us on Facebook too. And thanks to all those who added their voice to today's conversation on being prepared for the worst. And thanks to our guests again, Lauren DeAviso, also Linda Zambrano and Patrick Vacha. And now we're going to go back to Las Vegas, Nevada once again to hear from Choctaw Cherokee broadcaster and rodeo announcer Randy Taylor. He's been covering the Indian National Finals Rodeo this week at the South Point Event Center. And Randy is also the host of Native Voice One's program, Word with a Champ. And he gives us a rundown of the latest rodeo highlights.
The Indian National Finals Rodeo 40th Annual Celebration features 8 different events, a full venue of rodeo action, and the competition looks this way. In the bareback bucking horse riding competition, Mescalero Apache J.R. Chino from Arizona is your leader. He was on Showboy. In the steer wrestling competition, Joe Wilson, Ogallala Lakota from South Dakota, is looking for another world title. He was a 5-second time, winning the round tonight. You think the cowboys are competitive? These cowgirls really are. They are in 2 events. Heidi Cooney, Ogallala Lakota from South Dakota, is winning round 3 with a 2.75 second time. Cheyenne River Sioux Tate Longbreak from South Dakota is at the top of the list with an 81-point ride. He was on Gray Away, a Fraser bucking horse from Montana that is a very, very good horse. They won the short round at Four Bears Casino on that horse as well. The cowboys that perfect the traditional art of working cattle are our tie-down ropers. Chad Johnson is leading that competition, roped the calf, dismounted the horse, ran down the rope, flanked the calf, tied up 3 legs in 8.41 seconds. That is phenomenal. Tyson and Casey Green, they were a quick 5.41 second time representing the Navajo Nation. The other ladies' event is a horse race. They run in a cloverleaf pattern. It's called the barrel racing. Genevieve Tuscaleras is the fastest tonight in round 3 with 15.76 seconds. Everybody's favorite, bull riding. Donnie Whirlwind Horse is in lead of round number 3. The judge is marking him a 71-point ride. The bull he had is Virgil Begay's bull, a Navajo stock contractor called Dirty Max from New Mexico. We head into performance number 6 Friday night to conclude round number 3. Our guest today is a Seminole Indian cowboy by the name of Jacoby Johns. He also participates in the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, and he is a winner in and out of the arena. Hello, Jacoby.
Hello, Randy. Thank you for having me.
Oh, the pleasure is ours, as always. You're looking for your first gold buckle in an Indian World Championship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to get that first gold buckle, even trying to get my first go-round buckle. I've yet to get one of them, but I'm real close. I've been right there, right beside them, so I'm going to get it here soon.
What does the 40th Annual Indian National Finals Rodeo mean to you?
Oh, it means that we're doing well. We're keeping on going, and there's many more years to come because we got our youth Indians coming up and all our kids coming up. So I'm just glad it's gone this long, and it's going to keep going for many more years.
We've been visiting with a very talented bareback bronc rider, Seminole Indian Cowboy Jacoby Johns. Jacoby, sic'em, partner.
Thank you, Randy.
Other people that prepare for bareback riding competition include the stock contractors and the people that own the bucking horses. Chancey Kitson is the livestock superintendent. That is a huge responsibility for the animal athletes, and sometimes they're not just a herd in your pasture. They're part of the family.
Yes, very much so. I mean, this is a family event, and the sport of raising bucking horses, that's what they're family traditions, and they do become part of your family.
So the bloodlines in these animals have changed, and that has made a huge difference in our sport.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Maybe 10 years ago, the Indian contractors might have had just a sour saddle horse that didn't buck. But now, in today's present day, the contractors are raising horses from the bloodlines, from the Calgary Stampede, Harry Vold, back to Suttons and Corcos. We have them coming from all four directions, as you would say, which is great as a native people.
Chancey, thank you very much for the job that you do and the time you take to make sure this event is run properly and the stock is treated like the athletes they are.
Thank you, Randy.
Chancey Kitson, Pekuni Indian Cowboy from the Blackfeet Country in Montana. Thanks for listening from the 40th Annual Indian National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas. This is Choctaw Cherokee Cowboy reporting, Randy Taylor.
And you can hear Randy's Daily Rundown once again on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. And there is more live coverage of this year's Indian National Finals Rodeo, which is streaming live on Native Voice 1 through Saturday, courtesy of affiliate station KHEW, the voice of the Chippewa Cree Nation on the Rocky Boy Reservation. Thanks again to Randy Taylor for keeping us close to the action at this year's rodeo. Monday, we welcome First Nations author and journalist Wab Kanu to talk about his memoir, The Reason You Walk. Art Hughes is our executive producer. Monica Brain is our senior producer. Andy Murphy is our associate producer. Our engineer is Stephen Emmons. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood. Join us again on Monday.
This program supported by the Peace Corps, the government agency sending thousands of volunteers to live and work alongside people in more than 60 countries worldwide. The Peace Corps will allow you to share your unique cultural heritage and promote world peace and friendship. We have rewarding work opportunities around the world in education, health, agriculture, environment, and business. It will change your life and the lives of others. More information available at peacecorps.gov. That's peacecorps.gov.
Our children and grandchildren look to us for guidance, wisdom, and comfort. Let's make sure staying healthy is a message we share with them. Medicaid, the CIP, and the health insurance marketplace offer free or low-cost health coverage for our families. Protect your family by enrolling for health coverage today. Birchi.
A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.